Our next guest likes to use his dangerous vision to imagine the investment landscape of the future, as well as solutions in ophthalmic diagnosis and treatment. Hear how he marries the two and develops rules of thumb for investment strategies that last. Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Randy Cohen, who is senior lecturer at Harvard Business School. His main research focus is the interface between the actions of institutional investors and price levels in the stock market, and he has helped to start and grow a number of investment management firms. He's a partner at Excite Capital, a venture capital firm specializing in early stage impact investments in innovative ophthalmologic diagnostic and treatment solutions. Welcome, Randy. Thanks for joining me today.
It's great to talk to you.
Can you walk us through your background and what led you to your interest in the stock market and investing?
Sure. Let's see. We'll start at the beginning. I grew up in Philadelphia, and I was really interested in math when I was a kid. That was my primary thing that I cared about, was excited to go to college and study math. I was lucky enough to be admitted to Harvard, and that's when I found out how good at math the people are who are truly, truly good at math. You know, I guess it's like being the high school football star who, you know, makes it to University of Alabama and then discovers, you know, they're your sixth string. So that was a real adjustment for me, and I honestly wasn't quite sure what to do with myself. I'd never thought that much about careers except for a vague thought that, you know, maybe I could teach or whatever. In high school, I had done high school cross-ex debate, as they call it. But in college, I got really interested in parliamentary debate, the style, of course, developed in Britain and Ireland that perhaps you're familiar with. And I just loved it. And so I would sort of spend all week doing math problem sets and all weekend at debate tournaments. And I had kind of a realization a year or two after college. I thought, I'm not the best debater, although I was good. And I'm a million miles. I like to joke that I was the dumbest person in my class at Harvard because everybody else was either better than me at math or smart enough not to be a math major. So I was like, okay, I'm a million miles from the best at math and I'm not the best at debate, but I'm better at math than any of the other people on the debate circuit. And I'm a better talker than all these math people. There ought to be a way to put these two skills together. And later I found out that the writer A.J. Liebling had a more succinct version of this, being a professional writer. He said, I don't write the best and I don't write the fastest, but I write faster than anyone who writes better, and I write better than anyone who writes faster. And so I said, okay, you know, now it's just a search problem to figure out what profession could kind of bring those skills together. And it turned out that being a finance professor was the way to go, that, you know, it kind of had that mathematical thinking element, but also the talking element. And of course, there are a lot of jobs on Wall Street that also would have suited. So I've been very fortunate in sort of the academic lottery. I got into University of Chicago's PhD program, which I feel was the very best program in finance at that time. Studied with the amazing Eugene Fama, learned so much, got a job teaching at Harvard. And I've been teaching at Harvard for the last 25 years, other than a few years break over at MIT. And one thing that's great about Harvard Business School is they're super encouraging of people having a foot in the real world. You know, they really want us. The students wouldn't be happy if we were just teaching from textbooks or technical material or anything like that. They want to know what's really happening out there on Wall Street and not what was happening 20 years ago, but what's happening now. So that's caused me to get involved in lots of investment projects, which have been, you know, quite fascinating.
I'd like to go into that now, the investing project side of things. So what kind of history did your investing career have? When did you start investing? What interested you there?
Well, I would say, you know, it's funny because I helped a friend start a hedge fund years ago, early 2000s. And I remember talking to one of my colleagues and they were like, oh, wow, you know, there's probably good money in the hedge fund business, acting like they wish they had something like that going. And I was like, well, you know, just so you know, this is the eighth attempt I've made to start some kind of investments related business since I became a professor. And so what you have to ask yourself is, well, after the first one didn't get off the ground, and then the second one didn't get off the ground, and then the third and fourth and fifth ones didn't get off the ground, would you have done a sixth one? And if the answer is yes, well, after the sixth one and the seventh one didn't get off the ground, would you have done the eighth one? So there were lots of efforts in lots of different areas of investing. So I guess the answer is I've always, for certainly at least since I started studying finance, or got interested in enough in studying finance in the mid-90s to consider doing it. I've just, you know, wanted to invest. I've always loved the idea of trying to be analytical and manage risk and take risks in smart ways. So in the end, that led to a number of projects related. What I studied, my research was really on areas related to what we would call quantitative investing. You know, so I worked on projects related to how can we use analytics to identify stocks that will outperform. You know, that was sort of the main area I was working in. And, you know, obviously it's a natural, if you're doing that kind of research, to want to apply it to the real world. But then I actually ended up also working on a lot of projects that were a little less of that analytical quantitative approach, because I have lots of friends going all the way back to middle school and in college and so forth, who were interested in small company investing, where you're talking about venture capital or growth equity or what have you. And so I got involved in a lot of projects of that type. And so, for example, Xsight, it's a venture firm that only invests in blindness cures, because I'm blind myself from retinitis pigmentosa. And so obviously that got me very interested in the subject. And talking to researchers, what we found was they could get grant money. And then if you had something that was hugely profitable, well, that's fine. You could grow that. But in between, there was this valley of death that was very challenging for them, where they were kind of had a business, so it didn't look like something you should give grants to, but they weren't making money yet. And so we've been working to fund really exciting companies in that area to try to cure blindness and be therapies for vision loss.
Well, we're definitely going to dig into that a little bit more, because we've had some other guests on the podcast speaking a lot about technological advancement around blindness and other vision impairments. And that was Matt Sherwood, who we're both no in common. But just before that, just on the investing side, so you said you spent over two decades, we discussed now, at Harvard Business School, and watching the evolution of investing. We're now sitting here in 2024, still kind of marveling, I suppose, at the dominance of the Magnificent Seven. And, you know, we've heard a lot about active, passive investing. Any kind of truths, I suppose, that you've settled on after studying investing for as long as you have, that you've come to realize maybe that certain forms are dead in the water, that certain forms are only at their beginning? Where is your thinking around investing broadly at this stage?
Yeah, well, it was so great studying at University of Chicago. Eugene Fama, of course, won the Nobel Prize for, among other things, developing the efficient markets hypothesis and kind of demonstrating through a long series of papers how difficult it is to beat the stock market and how simple strategies that seem like they might work don't do that much, right? At the same time, he also got enormous credit for developing, together with Ken French, the Fama-French five-factor model, which identifies a set of characteristics of companies which do, on average, tend to outperform. Now, you can argue that those companies might be riskier, but it's really not obvious that they're riskier. Like, one of the factors is a profitability factor. So more profitable companies tend to outperform. Now, if I told you that companies with horrible negative profits tend to outperform, you might say, okay, but those are risky investments. But if I tell you that the more profitable companies, which seem like, if anything, they'd be safer to invest in, also are the ones that outperform, then you start to think there may be some opportunity to get edge in the markets. So the way I think of it as, the first step is recognizing that things are pretty darn efficient. And then the second step is recognizing they're not perfectly efficient. And I like to refer to this as the lot, little, little, lot world. I say, when you talk about liquid investments, we live in a lot, little, little, lot world. And what that means is there are a lot mispriced by a little, and a little, I suppose I should grammatically say a few, but it doesn't sound as good, a little mispriced by a lot, okay? And so let's say you're talking about 3,000 or so U.S. companies, right? These are reasonably traded, you know, the Russell 2000 and the 500 in the middle and the S&P 500, so you have Russell 3,000 companies. So what I'd say is, there are, on any given day, there are hundreds of those companies, maybe 1,000, that are mispriced by 1% or 2%. So that is a lot mispriced by a little. But I want to be clear, you know, what I mean by a lot and a little in that context. And then when I say there's a little mispriced by a lot, what I mean is there's dozens, maybe even 100, that are mispriced by 5 or 10%. Okay? So if somebody comes to you and they tell you they've identified a publicly traded company, and even though they don't have any illegal inside information, they believe that they can prove to you that it's mispriced by 30 or 50%, you should be pretty skeptical. Now, we can't say for sure that there aren't three or five companies on any given day that are mispriced by 30 or 50%, but there can't be a ton of them. And the one way we know there can't be a ton of them is by looking at activist investors, right? If you look at the data on activist investors, they do incredibly well as a group, right? My friend Alon Brav and his co-authors down at Duke wrote a paper where they showed that when they buy a company, that company jumps on the news of their purchase by around 7%. and then they hold those gains. Okay. So that company is going to be a 7% winner. All right. Now consider that these activists, they get to maybe just buy two or three or five companies a year. So they're really, really concentrated and focused on their best investments. And they have lots of tools at their disposal. They can go fight to make those companies better and all. And when you add up all those benefits, they're finding 7% a year of edge. So you might say that's a combination of the activist advantage plus the underpricing they identified. Those two added up only get you to 7%. So it tells you there just can't be large numbers of companies mispriced by 30 or 50%. But I do think there are a non-trivial number mispriced by 5 or 10%. And as I say, a much larger number mispriced by 1 or 2%. And so then when you ask yourself, how can we beat the market in a meaningful way? Well, if you take the typical mutual fund, what are they going to have in a portfolio of 100 stocks? They're going to have 45 stocks that they bought 1% or 2% cheap, lot mispriced by a little. And they're going to have 45 stocks that they thought they bought 1% or 2% cheap, but they paid fair price for because nobody's perfect, right? This is a hard business. And then you're going to have five stocks maybe that they got 5 or 10% cheap, right? Because those are the little mispriced by a lot that they take advantage of. And then maybe there's five stocks where they blew it and they overpaid by 1% or 2%. You take a weighted average of all that and you say, okay, these guys ought to outperform by about 1.5% a year. And sure enough, that is how much mutual funds outperform by on average. Okay, they win by one or what before fees and trading costs. Once you take into account fees and trading costs, of course, the outperformance gets down to zero or a little below zero, right? And so that kind of tells you what investing is all about. So now if we ask ourselves, how can we deliver really good performance? How can we deliver, let's say, single digit, high single digit alpha, right? Let's say we want to outperform by 5 or 10% a year. Well, we're either going to need to concentrate in that lot mispriced by a little, right? Or we're going to need to get outside the lot little, little lot world by being in illiquids. Or we're going to need to have very rapid turnover. So we take those small mispricings, but by the end of the year, we've made that 1% or 2% a whole bunch of times, right? And so that's going to require a high velocity trading strategy, not necessarily ultra high velocity, but you're going to need to turn over once every month or two at the minimum. Or you're going to need to use leverage. And we know the problems associated with leverage, but still. And those are really your choices if you're going to try to deliver really good performance in the lot, little, little, lot world. So let me pause there because that's a bit of a mouthful.
Well, that is certainly is a lot to handle. And just when we're speaking about the lot, little, lot, little, I have to go back over that one. But that is fascinating because it really does, I suppose, deal with perhaps some of the more, I wouldn't say extinct, but certainly decaying side of the market. I'm thinking of kind of large cap, efficient.
Yeah, these companies are pretty efficiently priced. The market is pretty smart. I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to say, yeah, you're exactly right. They're pretty efficiently priced. So you got to manage your expectations if you're going to invest in those. Now, look, of course, in any short period of time, if you just bought NVIDIA a couple of years ago, you'd look like a genius, right? Your performance would be terrific, right? And maybe NVIDIA was actually underpriced significantly. Maybe what happened is they got a lot of good news and the development of AI and it's embraced by society and so forth. And that's great, right? If you get good news, you're going to win. So there's always going to be people who outperform by more than what this sounds like. But when you look at the whole bell curve of performance, you're going to see it's consistent with this. And when you look to see how much persistence there is in performance, there's not all that much. So in other words, the way this theory could be wrong is if you had people in liquid securities, you had mutual fund managers who are consistently outperforming by 5, 8, 10% a year. And that just doesn't seem to be the case, right? We just don't see people with that kind of, the people who have really good long-term track records are outperforming by 1 or 2% a year, right? And what that suggests is, okay, instead of my 45, 45, 5, 5, the numbers are a little more tilted in their favor, right? If they can get 55 in the ones that are mispriced by 1 or 2% and 10 in the ones that are mispriced by 5 or 10% and hardly any in the ones that are overpriced, then you can get up to 1 or 2% annual outperformance beyond your fees and trading costs, and then you're a superhero.
And then just related to the existential nature, I suppose, of investment management firms, given what you've just said, where it's possible to make money today, clearly we've talked about funds that are operating in areas that perhaps have less alpha opportunity today. You said you've started eight attempts at starting firms.
Oh, well, that was before the first success. And I want to be clear. I don't want you to think that we like launched them and they had horrible returns. In fact, I mean that we've made a lot of effort to try to raise money into an idea and then we weren't able to raise enough money for it to make sense to go forward with that idea or what have you. So, you know, it wasn't like we had lots and lots of terrible performance historically. But, you know, yeah, performance is hard. Now, again, one of the ways in which you can avoid the lot, little, little, lot world is to be in illiquids, right? And the story that always resonated with me was I had a student who came to me. Like, the student comes to me and they say, hey, I've been looking at Apple stock and I think it's only worth half of what the market thinks. I have to say to them, look, with all due respect, I'm sure your analysis is very, very smart. But even if you're the smartest person in the market, that's not good enough. You have to be smarter than the combined wisdom of everybody in the market for Apple. And that is really asking too much. Like, you just can't expect to be right on that. But I had a student walk into my office one day and said, hey, there's a huge opportunity in Bulgarian farmland. And I'm like, oh, really? He said, yes. He said, we aren't in the EU. This is years ago. We're not that far from Germany, but we can't sell to Germany because we're not in the EU. So we have to sell east, right, into Russia and other Eastern European countries that are much poorer. And so the sorghum we grow is just as good as the sorghum they grow in France, but we sell it for a fraction of the price. And so, but we're going to be admitted to the EU. It might be next year, it might be in 5 years, but it's not going to take 20 years. And so if you buy farmland in Bulgaria, you can rent it out to a farmer for 4% a year. And then when the switch gets flipped, the prices go way up, you'll be able to sell for 3 times what you paid. And here's the thing. I could not look that student in the eye and say, you're crazy. There's no way you're smarter than the whole market on it, right? Because there's not a million people analyzing Bulgarian farmland looking for bargains, right? Of course he could be right. Now, he could be totally wrong, but there's a chance. When you get into illiquids, there is a chance for that kind of large, persistent outperformance. Now, by the way, just in case you're curious, many years later, I told that story in class and a student raised his hand and said, I'm Bulgarian. Would you like to know how that worked out? I said, I've been dying to know for years whether the trade worked out. He said, it paid off exactly the way your student said it would, right on the money. But if you had been willing to bet on Bulgaria joining the EU and thriving in the way it actually has, he said, you'd have made way more money if you'd bought apartments in downtown Sofia, the capital, rather than buying farmland. So that's another powerful finance lesson, right? What's the alternative? You always have to make sure if you're willing to take on Bulgaria risk, okay, is farmland the best way to take on Bulgaria risk, or is there a better opportunity in Bulgaria?
I'm just moving on to talk a little bit about Excite. Could you tell us a bit about your own story of losing your site and how that has affected, I suppose, your access to the financial services industry? And is there a lesson there in terms of improvements that need to be made, first of all, for other people in similar situations?
Yeah. So I have, as I mentioned, retinitis pigmentosa, which is the way they name these diseases in Latin. Retinitis means there's something wrong with your retina, and pigmentosa means it has something to do with pigments, which is this. Say, if you look into my eyes, you'll see in the green part of my eye, there are these little black spots. I can't see them, of course. Even when I was young, I couldn't see well enough to see them. But, you know, if you looked in with a scope, you'll see them. And although they're not the cause of the problem, they are a symptom. And that's the way that an eye doctor will know right away, oh, this looks like retinitis pigmentosa. So these little bone spicules, as they call them. And it's a degenerative condition. So when I was young, I had very bad eyesight, very nearsighted. But that said, with glasses, if the light was good, I was fine. I played sports. I played baseball and ping pong and basketball. And as I got older, I could play basketball, but I couldn't play ping pong anymore because I couldn't follow the ball. And then, you know, eventually I even had to give up basketball in my 40s when probably I should have stopped playing basketball just because I was old and out of shape. So the point is, it's been a slow process. And I just want to say I've been so incredibly lucky, and I want to salute the amazing, well, so many amazing people, but for starters, the amazing engineers and business people and scientists who've developed incredible technologies so that most things that I did before with eyesight, I can now do using hearing and touch and other things. And the iPhone in particular that I'm holding in my hand is just outrageously good as an accessibility tool. And for people who are interested in this subject, if you have anybody in your life who's lost their sight, go to my website, dangerousvision.com. I have a little joke that, you know, it's like, oh, they describe people who can't see well, but who aren't totally blind as having like low vision or partially sighted or legally blind. It all sounds depressing and negative. I wanted a sexier term. So I say, you know, I have just enough vision to be dangerous. I have dangerous vision. So if you go to dangerousvision.com, I've got a lot of advice on assistive technologies because there have been incredible breakthroughs. And I also have to say that just Harvard is astonishingly supportive. My family and friends are amazing. People, Uber drivers, just random strangers. So many people are helpful. And so in the end, I honestly think I'm working at probably 85% or 90% of the efficiency I would be working with if I could see. So it definitely costs me in certain areas. But I am in a privileged position by getting to work with institutions like Harvard Business School, or to get, you know, in the startups I work in like Excite, I work with amazing people who are very supportive of me. And so when I say, look, I just can't make a spreadsheet anymore, they don't say you're fired. They say, oh yeah, we got to get somebody else to work on the spreadsheet, but can you call them and tell them what we're trying to build here? And so that's kind of my take, is that if you are as lucky as I am in terms of the support, both in terms of now the good news is the technology is not hugely expensive. I mean, I recognize that not everybody can afford an iPhone, but if it's the difference between being able to interact with the world and not, almost everybody, at least in the US, could. And the Android phones, I think the features, the assistive tech is not quite as good, but it's still excellent, right? Still excellent. So what I'd say is, with tremendous support, you can come a long way. Now, that said, there's a statistic out there that 75% of blind people are unemployed. And I've asked people who are experts, I'm like, well, is that because most blind people are very old and therefore they're unemployed because they're retired, essentially? And it's hard to get a straight answer. I would guess that the percentage of blind people under 65 or under 55 who are blind, most do work. But definitely there are challenges. And so I'm here to say, number one, yes, there are real challenges. Number two, those challenges absolutely can be overcome. The technology is there, and if people are supportive, you can do an enormous amount. I have a student from a couple years ago at Harvard Business School named Catherine Webster, who works at KKR now, and she is amazing and started an organization to help young people who are blind, as she is. And you know, she came to see me because she was a blind student at HBS, and she wants to help them thrive and achieve their career goals. And they're working miracles, and a lot of great companies have been very supportive of her. So there's a lot that can be done. And then, of course, over at X-Sight, we're investing in companies that we think can help. We sometimes look at adaptive companies, but most of our investments are in companies that are working towards cures of blindness, vision loss, and so forth. And there's been astonishing progress in lots of areas. And we're not there yet on my eyes, and we're not there yet on most people who have blindness, but we're really making headway on it.
Well, that's so profound. And we will put those links in the show notes, because I think that's exactly the experience that previous guests who are blind on this podcast have shared, is that gap around employment. Mm-hmm. And then also the gap around expectations. And I suppose the inclusion that does not flow then because of this gap around expectations of what can be done. And I think what probably is not fully realized is just how much technology has bridged that gap and is rapidly continuing to do so.
It's really been so rapid recently. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, exactly. Sorry. The point is how rapid it's been, I think, is the most extraordinary part. But then the education is needed, because if even those within the community are grappling with this new technology, it's the employers outside the community who perhaps don't know about the extent of the enablement. There's an education process needed, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm on the board of the Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and I had conversations with the people there, and I said, look, it seems to me that the most effective thing that we can spend a dollar on, if we want to have an impact on the lives of people suffering vision loss, the number one thing is letting people know what's out there, like just to take advantage of the opportunity to reach your audience with one comment. If you go to bookshare.org, bookshare.org, that's an incredible service for people with vision loss and other disabilities that prevent them from reading, in which you can download almost any book. They have over 1 million books on the platform. If you have low vision but can still read, if the text is sort of, you know, magnified and you have high contrast, you can get a file on your computer. It looks like you're reading a web page, and you can make it any size you want. And it's just a web page that goes on for hundreds of pages because you're reading an entire book. And I used that for years. And then when my eyesight got too poor to be able to read that way, I switched to using a technology called Voice Dream Reader, which costs $10, not $10 a month, $10 once. And for $10, it will read you these files at any speed you want, in any voice you want. And it is absolutely unbelievable. And many people will be like, oh, my father's lost his sight. He misses reading books. I'm like, we absolutely can fix that. Now, of course, people have audiobooks, which are great too. But a lot of people find audiobooks too slow once they get used to it. You know, if you look, the last Harry Potter book, I believe the audiobook is 17 hours long. And so there's people who are like, yeah, I want to read that book, but 17 hours is a little much. For me, that book is maybe 4 or 5 hours long, because I can have the automated voice read at high speed. So that's just one example of a kind of technology that's absolutely game-changing, whether it's for getting work done or for education and entertainment.
You probably are like me, and I think Matt and I share this. I listen to books on 2.25x, but mm-hmm. So I'm sure I can only imagine the speeds at which you're listening to, but it does take getting used to, but it's efficient.
It's about 3x, but what I'll say is I had trouble getting audiobooks to that high speed, because if you have like James Earl Jones intoning the book, and then you triple that, that can be very hard to understand. But the robot voice, even though they don't sound as nice as human voices, they scale very, very well. So that's what I find, is that I'm able to go faster than I can if I speed up a traditional human-read audiobook. And I admit I'm missing out on something. I've read articles about the person who does the audiobooks of Harry Potter, and he does like 75 different voices. And kudos to him. That's totally amazing. And I'm a huge admirer of that kind of work. But I'm just in a little too much of a hurry.
Absolutely. And one more word on Excite Capital, because I know you went through what it's doing. I just like to focus on breakthrough and innovation that you're excited about in that space, because we talked about the technology, but I'm sure that the medicine is also making advances too.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And you know, if you think about curing blindness, or at least let's say retinal disease, which is what I have, it, which is one of the most common forms of blindness, there's really three ways to go, right? And so there's the stem cells. What that says is, okay, if the rods or cones or both that you have in your eye are failing, let's put in new cells that in the environment of the back of the eye can turn into new rod or cone cells and restore vision. So that's a very exciting path. Obviously, there were setbacks because, you know, stem cell research was very limited for a long time and so forth, but there's tons of excitement in that area. Then second, there's gene therapy, which I kind of can't even believe exists and works, where they design a custom virus that goes into each cell and replaces the bad chunk of RNA with a good chunk of RNA to fix the defect in the cell that's leading to the problems. And as you probably know, gene therapy has been used to cure LCA, one of the worst forms of blindness, and people get it when they're young and then they lose their sight and can never recover. And now there's a treatment from Spark Therapeutics where one injection in each eye, and it's only been a few years, but as far as they can tell, people will never lose their sight. And if they need a booster in 10 or 20 years, we can do that. That doesn't work for what I have yet, but they're hard at work on the gene therapy solution. And then finally, the third one is the chip, right? And that's the idea of saying, hey, you know, when you think about what your retina is, the reason retinal disease is so hard to cure is that the retina is really part of your brain, right? It's nerve cells in some sense. And that's the part of the body that obviously we've had the least success in fixing, right? We're a lot better at fixing trouble with your bones or your liver than with the brain. But, you know, they're making a lot of headway there. But what's interesting is if you think about what the retina does, basically every time a photon, a little bit of light hits it, it kicks off an electron. And then your brain incredibly interprets this array of millions and billions of electrons hitting it every second and turns it into thoughts, you know, and says, oh, that looks like a car or a puppy dog or whatever. So if you think about it, we have solar cells, right? A photoelectric cell, like a solar cell that powers your home. That's the same technology, right? Every time it photon hits it, it sends off an electron to create electricity. And so in theory, you think, well, we could make a solar cell that goes in your eye and sends out those electrical signals. And they have them and they work. And people are getting something like a 16 by 16 grid of image, you know, so it's very blocky. But we all know about Moore's law, you know, where you have the doubling every 5 years or whatever it might be. And you can see that if you have that kind of improvement in the chip technology, you can work miracles. And my doctor friends are skeptical of the chip. Okay. Their view is you're never going to make something out of metal and silicon and all that can match a billion years of evolution. And they may be right. But what I will say is the reason I think the chip may end up being just as good or even better than the others for some applications is if the chip works, it's not a $1 billion product. It's a $1 trillion product because it's not just blind people who are going to want that. If you have a chip that can send electrical signals to your brain that are like vision, then you can basically watch movies or play video games or travel to other parts of the world in your head, right? You don't need a computer screen or anything like that. It's just in your head. Everybody is going to want that implant. And so now you've got something that's off the charts. And so when you think about what a venture capitalist might want to get excited about, it's top of the list. So I can't tell you in the end which is going to be the winner in 5 years, in 10 years, in 100 years, but they're all incredibly exciting technologies and we're working on all of it.
Well, just I want to spend one more time on what you just said there, what a venture capitalist might get excited about, because I think this is a good sort of slight segue into inclusive capitalism, because I've done some series here focused on women's health. I've just done a mini series focused on maternal mortality. And there are, it has to be said, many areas of health that are being overlooked, underfunded, because they don't affect the majority. And something like eyesight, clearly with an aging population, degenerative diseases, this is probably going to affect more people than, say, some women's health issues. which are maybe quite discreet. Do you find that there is enough interest, perhaps, in funding this area, enough buy-in, enough kind of relevance to the body of capital that moves? Because that seems to be an issue in certain parts of healthcare.
I would say there definitely wasn't at one point. And then there was a deal a couple decades ago, iTech, that came public for $1 billion. And I think kind of was a shock to the system. People are like, wait, what? You've got something to treat a particular eye disease and it's worth $1 billion. But when people did the math and said, wait a minute, how many people? Because look, you know, being blind, as I say, society's been so supportive of me that I feel very lucky. But we all know being blind is no picnic. It's very high on the list of things people want to avoid, things that people are horrified by. So if people have it, and as you say, with an aging population, degenerative conditions like macular degenerations, people really want that cured and they will pay up for treatment or for insurance that will pay for a treatment should it happen to them. And you can see you got 8 billion people in the world. Okay, fine. Maybe only 1 or 2 billion of them are in the wealthier countries that can afford insurance of this type. But let's say you have 2 billion people. If something affects 1% of the people, that's 20 million. And if they're willing to pay $1 million to get that problem fixed, that's 20 trillion, right? So the numbers get big really fast. And even if they're only willing to pay $100,000, that's 2 trillion, right? So you can see you have truly enormous numbers here. And so I think the world has sort of caught on to that. Look, there is a challenge. One of the reasons that Xcyte has thrived is that two of our partners are two of the world's top clinicians slash researchers, ophthalmologists. One is Mike Nissen, who's at Cornell Weill in New York, and Firas Rahul is out at UCLA. So when people have a deal in this area, you know, you sort of think about it. If they come to a typical venture firm, that firm has people on their healthcare team. It's not likely anybody there has any expertise in the back of the eye, right? Because they have a healthcare group and the back of the eye is one of, let's say, 500 body parts of similar significance. You know, you got to have somebody who's an expert on heart and you have to have somebody who's an expert on kidneys. You know, you can see it adds up. So you're just not going to have that kind of deep expertise. But the challenge we have as Xcyte is it is a bit of a hard sell to go to people. Let me step back actually and talk about investing more generally and tie it into this. If you invited me to a conference to give a 1-hour talk on investing, one of the key elements of that talk would be me saying to you, look, the way you get investing outperformance is with real specialized expertise and people who are willing to take concentrated positions in their specialized area of expertise. So you don't want somebody saying, oh, I know about all the stocks in all the countries and I'm going to pick 200 of them, right? What you want is somebody who says, I know a ton about this very specialized area and I'm going to find 5 amazing companies in that area. And then you want to get a portfolio where you have 100 managers like that. So you've got 500 positions, but each picked by a bespoke process expert in that area. And of course, you're not going to just recapitulate the market because one person's just doing the back of the eye and one person's just doing geothermal power and one person's just doing artificial intelligence in Southeast Asia. And so that's really the optimal way to invest for alpha, right? So in a way, we fit right in because we're the people doing the vision stuff. And for a little fraction of your money, for 1/500th of your money, put it with us, right? The problem is most people are not set up to find 500 specialized, brilliant, bespoke managers across 500 different areas of the economy. So they have a tendency to invest with generalists who don't deliver much, if any, after fee alpha. And so the problem is it's hard to raise money for that specialized thing because the way people invest instead is they say, look, I'm going to put 90% of my money in 20 or 30 really good generalists, and then I'm going to pick 10 or 20 specialists to give 0.5% each to, right? And then the question is, well, gee, but there's so many different things to specialize in. What's the chance they're going to pick the back of the eye guys? And the answer tends to be a lot of our investors are people who, because they themselves or their family members have blindness issues or they have a reason to care about the cause, they say, well, not only do these guys seem to be really good investors, but there's a social impact aspect in something I care about. And that's fine. That's a perfectly good way to run a business. But a better way, but what I'm saying is if we ask ourselves, if we step back, who cares whether our business succeeds? If we step back and say, from society's perspective, if we want to cure women's health problems, if we want to cure blindness, if we want to cure kidney disease, how many resources need to go into this? Well, what you need is for risk capital to be properly diversified. And my friend, well, a colleague still, but was my boss over at MIT, Andrew Lowe, who you may know, he has been doing incredible work in this area, trying to help people figure out how they can invest in companies that are high risk, high return, and by diversifying across lots of them, reduce that risk element. And that's what's needed to get get all these problems cured.
Brilliant. Well, I love how we brought it back to investment portfolio construction methodology and where the efficiencies lie. And I completely agree with that point around specialization. One of our previous podcasts, I'll put a link in the show notes with Steve Kim of Verdus Investment Management. He speaks about around the unicorns that are lying in the variation and the importance of proper diversification with venture capital among these specialties, because, you know, essentially you need this because you don't know where those unicorns will come from. So I think there is a whole debate probably around the optimal way to diversify a venture capital portfolio. And thanks for raising that there. And this is, again, the other reason why it's important to have diverse workforces is because then we have more people for whom a more variety of topics resonate, which is, again, they can identify and they can see impact. I think it's our ability to understand impact, to detect it, to decipher it, that is, it really helps our ability to build portfolios. I'd love to get onto some reflection questions. We have rattled through this probably at 3x speed for most of the listeners. Instead of speeding this one up, they'll be slowing this one down. It would be great to just turn to some reflections and look, as you look back at your career so far, the investment ventures, the academic career, were there any particular setbacks or challenges professionally that you learned lessons from?
Oh, I mean, sure. Every day I screw up and every day I learn from those screw ups, I guess. Look, certainly it was a real learning experience going from guy with really bad eyesight to blind guy who could see a tiny bit. That was a real challenge and I had to work hard to overcome it. Fortunately, I feel like I'm in a good place, but there was definitely, you know, a period there where it was very difficult. And I remember talking to another person with RP and he said, yeah, sometimes I wish I'd just lose it all tomorrow. So I didn't have this feeling of like it just constantly getting worse. At least then I'd know I'm done. And I'm glad I didn't lose it all. The tiny bit I have is incredibly valuable. You know, I walk into walls 4 times a day, but walking into walls 40 times a day would be a lot worse. So anyway, that certainly was a setback. We certainly had investment businesses that had challenges. I mean, I had a fascinating experience where I helped a friend start a business that traded municipal bonds. And municipal bonds are a market where, on the one hand, it's pretty efficient. You're not going to see stuff mispriced by more than 1% or 2% virtually ever, right? So you're not going to see huge mispricings, except in very special circumstances. But a really smart trader can be a middleman or middle person and add value every day by, you know, kind of buy something for $98 and then you buy a bond. It's a Darien, Connecticut water bond. And then you wait until one of your contacts calls you and say, hey, I've got a guy who sold his vacation home and needs to buy some bonds that are Connecticut tax-free. What do you got? And you're like, oh, I've got these Darien, Connecticut water bonds. They're great. You know, I'll sell them to you for 99. And if you can make that buy for 98, sell for 99, over and over, you hold it for a month, that could be 12% a year. You know, that's a pretty great return. Well, so what happened is that the city of Detroit went bankrupt, right? So this really scared people because it seemed extremely possible that Chicago was going to go bankrupt and that other cities were going to go bankrupt and that other kinds of institutions would go bankrupt and water systems would go under. And so all the munis traded down dramatically. And we were like, look, we're just here to make that dollar spread. Munis will go down, munis will go up. We'll do better in the years when they go up. But we never pretended to you that, oh, this is going to be a great year for munis. Just think of it as that stuff's going to average out over time. Meanwhile, we'll just always be producing that alpha from trading in and out. And people's response was fascinating to observe, which is essentially they're like, look, I just got to take my money out. And I would say to them in the nicest possible way, look, you know that if we were not involved in this, if you were not invested in this fund, and I said, is this a good time to invest in munis, right, with all of them down dramatically, or is this a good time to avoid munis, you'd be like, oh my gosh, this is when you buy in. You buy in right after the crash. What did Baron Rothschild say? When there's blood in the streets, buy property, right? This is the buying opportunity. And they're like, I understand your logic, but I don't know what to tell you. It's down and I got to take my money out. So look, it was a painful lesson, and it's something that everybody managing money should think about. You either have to be in a situation where if that happens, you're okay. Now, let me be clear. There was no disaster there. We weren't levered, and we just gave everybody their money back. But it did mean that, you know, more or less that business shut down. And I think it was a great fund and a great business, and it wasn't good for the world that it shut down. It wasn't good for me, but it was what the investors wanted. So what's good about it is if we'd been levered 10 to 1 or something, it could have been some disaster scenario, and it wasn't. So in that sense, we handled it well, and our lives were structured in a way where it wasn't like, you know, anybody lost their house or, you know, had any problems. So we were pretty well set up. But all I'm saying is everybody in every investment business needs to understand that there are circumstances beyond their control. And if those things go against them, they're probably, unless you're Warren Buffett, you're probably going to lose your investors when those bad times come. And as long as everything's structured so that you don't need to panic, you give people their money back, you move on, you pursue your next project, that's okay. It may be a shame, but it's okay. Now, if you can structure your business so that that never happens, right? You can't really short munis, right? Because the problem is shorting a muni would essentially mean you are issuing a municipal bond. But municipal bonds, what makes them so great is they're tax-free. Well, I'm not allowed to issue tax-free bonds. So you can't short them. So there's no way to say we're going to protect against Detroit going bankrupt. But that's not true of everybody's business. So to the extent that you can create a business that protects against those kinds of downside risks, terrific. You may be able to keep your business going for 40 years. Otherwise, you kind of have to expect that when those circumstances come, investors are going to react in a way that 5 years later, they're going to look back and say, oh yeah, I shouldn't have taken my money out of that. But you can't convince them in the moment.
Tremendous lessons for investor psychology, more portfolio construction discipline there yet again. Key people. You've mentioned a number of people you've worked with, partners over the years. Was there anyone in particular that either was a mentor to you or had a particular impression or lasting effect on you?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I've been so blessed with the mentors I've had in my life. I mean, I already mentioned Eugene Fahm at the University of Chicago, who was my dissertation advisor. And the lessons that I think anybody who knows Gene will say that, among other things, the lessons they took away are, first of all, just keep doing the work. There's no substitute for just disciplined, organized, figure out what's going on, ask all the relevant questions, be hard on yourself, and keep working. And we watched Gene, and I was at an event he was speaking at recently, and I had the realization that, hey, when I was in grad school studying with him, he was younger then than I am now. And I thought he was a big grown-up old guy. But anyway, he's still working like crazy, still does great research, and just never stopped. And then also just being ruthlessly honest with yourself. Gene has views about market efficiency, but when someone comes in with a paper that argues against market efficiency, he's completely open to it, and he's willing to question his own beliefs and to, you know, change his views and so forth. And so it's just so impressive to watch that. But as I say, I've had so many. I mean, when I started at Harvard Business School, Robert Merton was teaching there, another Nobel laureate, and we would sit at lunch and we would just listen to Bob. And I would think, I'm going to tell my grandchildren about these points he made today. He would say these simple, elegant things. And you'd think, that should have been obvious to me, but it wasn't. But now that I know it, it's just going to change the way I see the world. He's just such a powerful thinker. And in fact, I'll say that's something I've noticed consistently. When I was teaching at MIT, I'd leave the seminar. And although there were all these brilliant people in there, including, you know, brilliant young scholars doing amazing new research, consistently, it was the legends, Steve Ross and Stuart Myers, who, of course, of Brilliant Myers fame, among other things, who I'd walk out with, they'd have made a comment that really resonated with me. So I guess that's another thing I've learned is just the nature of genius. Lou Reed from the Velvet Underground has a great line. He was talking about their song, Vicious. And they asked him how that song came about. And he said that Andy Warhol, the painter, walked up to him one day and said, you should write a song about the idea of being vicious. And Lou Reed said, what do you mean? And Andy Warhol said, you know, like you hit me with a flower. And Lou Reed said, that was it. The rest of the song just wrote itself because Andy Warhol's a genius. Like just saying that, like the rest of it just falls into place. And so these people who we're lucky enough to get to know in our lives, who have insights that just everything else seems, you know, it may be a lot of work to put all the other building blocks in place, but you need somebody with that insight. And so anyway, I've just been so fortunate with the people I've been around.
Well, reams and reams of bits of advice and nuggets there. Now, I suppose I'd just like to ask you, can you leave us with one that maybe encapsulates your philosophy now as you both integrate all of these amazing mentors you've had and leave us with something, maybe your creed or motto or word to live by?
It's funny, you know, when we were talking before, you mentioned a thing about advice to your young self, right? And that's a question I thought a lot about. In fact, when I was young, back when there were like bookstores and books and stuff, I thought, you know, it would be fun to write a book where you just went around and talked to thousands of different people. And for each person, you just ask them one question. If you could give some advice to your 10-year-old self or your 12-year-old self, what would you tell them? You know, other than, oh, buy stock in Google or something ridiculous, right? And I have asked that question to various people, but when I asked myself the question before I got to others, I thought, you know, I think my answer is, Randy, you're just as lazy and incompetent as you think you are, but everybody else, they're not as incredible as you think they are. Like, they have their issues too, and they're hiding, you know, they're putting their best face on the world. And so what you think is that you're the only one that's struggling, but it turns out everybody's in there struggling, right? So if you just stick with it and keep struggling, good things will happen. I got to work harder to put that in the shape of a motto, but that's kind of how I look at the world. Just, you know, all right, here's the motto. I'm going to give you a motto. This is something I say to my kids sometimes. There are very few problems in life that can't be solved with 100 hours of hard work.
Brilliant. Well, Randy, this has been the podcast, the gift that has just kept giving. We started out discussing your insights on investing and conclusions on the evolution of that. We segued into discussing blindness and some of the technologies that are out there, as well as some of the medical advances that are breaking ground. And we brought that back to portfolio construction again. And now we've weaved through multiple legends in the investment field. So thank you so much for coming here, for sharing these multiple insights with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was super fun.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear from more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.